Succession number 10293, reel 2.
So, you were saying you did this how many times?
And we did 13 trips a day. So the first aircraft that came back in the morning was also, of course, the last aircraft back at night because he got the extra trip in. Now, I was short of wireless operators. At that time, as I was in charge of the whole radio section and the ancillary trades down there. And I didn't have sufficient wireless ops, so to spell them out, I would do one of the trips. I would probably do the one odd trip a day. Because I was also, of course, I've been used to operating on the Vickers Valencias and Dakotas the whole time I was in India.
I'm surprised that so many trips could be crammed into the 24 hours.
It was because we were quick in turning around stuff. There was no wasted time at all. When an aircraft landed, the wounded were got off as quickly as possible, the aircraft was cleaned as quickly as possible, it was refueled when necessary and turned round and it went straight off. Nobody wasted a second. And I can't remember eating during the day. We had a lot of tea planters' wives there who used to set up a canteen every morning, and as the wounded came off, they were given a cup of tea and a cigarette and probably biscuits or whatever have you, but the main thing was tea. The tea planters' wives just used to brought bags of tea down, and you just kept going. There was, you had to. The blokes had to be brought out. So you didn't stop until it got dark. And then when it got dark, you pegged your aircraft down for the night, made sure they're okay, pegged them down for the night, and went to bed.
So it must have been very exhausting work then.
Yes, it was really, I suppose, at that time. It was hard, but we were a good squadron. We were a very good squadron. The Esprit de Corps was absolutely marvellous. It was 100%, there's no doubt about it. And everybody sort of mucked in with each other, and you just did your job. It was, nobody did anything special compared with anybody else. You all worked together and got cracking.
Were you ever interrupted by the Japanese forces?
No, not really. We were too far away from them. Our aircraft were. They were harried a little bit as they went in because the Japanese had the Zeros. But we were operating really behind the lines, you know, bringing out the wounded. We were always behind the lines, the front line. So it wasn't a hell of a lot. Not until the last day when we were going into Michener, and that was when we lost two aircraft in the morning. That was the final day of the evacuation. And we had three aircraft on the ground at Michener when the Japs came over and strafed them, and they got two of the aircraft, and one of the crew of one aircraft managed to scramble out and jump onto the third aircraft, which still had his engine running, so he just took off and went along the valley at treetop height and got out of the way. And then when the Japs finished the strapping and went away, he sort of came back to our base at Tezpur, it was then, you know. Just came back to base.
Were there women and children as well that you took out?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. Because if I can sort of carry on for you from that last day, really.
Yes.
We lost two aircraft and one crew was left there. And the crew included our CO. And we were stood down for the afternoon because there was nothing we could do. We knew the Japs were floating around Michener. And it was about, I don't know, 3 o'clock or something in the afternoon when one of the squad flight commanders, the squad leader, came down and said, "Can I have one of your wireless operators immediately?" And I said, "Well, they're all back at the sleeping quarters because they're all stood down." I asked him why he wanted one, and he said, "Well, we're going to go straight off and fly in and see if we can pick up the CO and the rest of the bots." So I said, "That's all right, I'll come." So he said, you know this? I said, I've been in before. You know, I've been doing trips nearly every day. So he said, right, we'll take off. How long do you want? I said, well, 5 minutes to get my books and arrange my call signs, etc., with the ground station, so that they knew what I was doing. And then I'll be ready. And I nipped across to the ground station, saw the chap in charge there, made my arrangements with regard to frequencies and call signs, etc. And then we jumped on board. And as we were going to our little takeoff position, as you say, it was only a grass airfield. One of the other officers came up and handed me a note which said, be careful, the Japs are over Michinon now. And keep your eyes skinned. So I told the two pilots, and the three of us went down. Absolute, you know, empty aircraft, two pilots sitting in the front, me at my wireless seat halfway down. And our armament was, the second pilot had a Tommy gun and I had a Tommy gun. And that was our armament. Of course, there's no armament on the Dakota. But I don't know where we got these two Tommy guns from, but we had two Tommy guns. And we flew down and landed at Michinon. And as we came in, our CO, the squadron leader, came out of the brush. It was Joel Jungle brush all the way around, apart from the river in the Irrawaddy River going through there. It's just a flat piece of land with a landing strip along by the side of the river. And the CO came out and he said, look, I've got a whole host of chaps spread around at the moment, out in the jungle. Give me half an hour, I'll get them all ready for you, in half an hour's time, land and we're away. So we took off again, and we flew up one of the valleys, and we were pretty well at treetop level, so we couldn't be seen in case the Japs came back. And we flew around for half an hour, 35 minutes actually, the pilot said, we'll give them an extra 5 minutes. And then we landed, and as soon as we landed, you could see people just running out of the scrub, everything. They were just pouring out towards our aircraft. And we put all the white people aboard. There was a load of natives, and there was one woman there, I still remember, a big fat lady, I should think round about the 30, 35 mark, carrying a little baby. And she thrust the baby into my arms and said, please, sir, take my baby. And I said, I can't. For two reasons. One, I must get the wounded on board. And secondly, where would the child be without you? Because I don't know where I could put it. The child is safe with you. But I've always remembered that. Please, to take my baby, to try and get the baby to safety, because she knew she wasn't safe. And I've often wondered to myself, would it have made any difference? What would have happened to the baby? Did the woman live? Would they have met up again? You know, that sort of thing always sticks in your mind. I can still remember that lady. Please, sir, take my baby. And I had to say no, because I thought it was best. I shall never know whether I did the right thing or not. But we got everybody on board, and then I said to the CEO, jump in. He said, you get in first, and I'll get in. We jumped in anyway. We weren't going to wild you. Not with Jap Giro's liable to come back at any second. And we flew back to Dinjan, and landed in Dinjan, absolutely pouring with rain, monsoon type of weather, pitch dark, and there were two glim lamps. I don't know if you know what a glim lamp is. There were three glim lamps, one at the edge of the airfield, and the other two at the top, so that it looked like a T, and we had to land on one side of that glim lamp and taxi up towards the other two. And I'll give the pilot this much. It was so smooth on that landing that the lads didn't realise that they were back on the ground until we'd rumbled about 20 or 30 yards. And I said, you're back. Smoothest landing, beautiful, absolutely perfect, in absolutely atrocious weather. And we taxied up to the end, and the second pilot was taxiing, the first pilot came out. And he looked at me and he said, Smithy, I want to know how many I've got on board. Will you count them? Because we're actually packed out. So I was first out of the door and I counted the people we came out. And in that Dakota, we had 47 passengers and three aircrew. 50 people in one Dakota.
Were the people in a pathetic condition?
No, because Previous ones were, yes. The ones that we're bringing up for the past few months before that, yes, some of those were in a pathetic condition. But mainly these were the sort of people who had been left behind, the people who were doing the work on the airfield, people like wireless operators and ground crew who were actually there and who had been gradually moving back with their own units. They'd been moving back all the time. So I would say that, I don't know if there was any wounded at that last one or not. I think they were probably all able-bodied people at that point, because it was just the people who managed to stagger to that last bit before it was overrun. And there were them, we got them out.
So on that last flight, were there Indians and Burmans that you took out as well?
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yes, as long as there were forces. As long as there were forces. There were white, there were Sikhs, there were Punjabis, there was Burma police. People on that nature, yes. They were all people who had something to do with an armed force. Navy, army, or Burmese people. Not civilians, though. We, as a matter of fact, of the RAF, only brought out forces people. The Americans, when they were flying in and out, because we had some Americans with us at one time, and they were bringing some civilians out where necessary, because they were not under the same rules as we were. They were semi-volunteer sort of thing. We weren't. We were part of the Royal Air Force. And we only brought out casualties and forces people, because that's what we were there for. We had to get out the people who'd been wounded to get them treatment. And then right at the end, when it was a complete overrun, we had to get the able-bodied people out. Because remember, they were the people who knew what had been happening inside Burma, knew how the Japanese worked and everything else, and of course could bring their knowledge back into India for, you know, the headquarters people who were working from there.
But there were some service people that had to be left on the airfield, though.
We didn't leave one serviceman on the airfield. We put every chap into the aircraft that was there on the airfield. But of course there were some which had already bypassed the airfield and gone on ahead into the hills for walking out over the hills. And they walked out.
And were there any civilians on that last flight?
No. All service people of one sort or another.
What other work did you do in Burma?
Well, of course, after we'd finished the evacuation, the next thing, of course, was to supply the troops who were still walking out. Because they were walking out over two ranges of mountains. They were walking out through thick jungle where they had to hack their way through. And they had anything from 100 to 120 miles to walk out through, that sort of stuff. So our job then was to supply drops and keep them supplied with clothing and food. Although some of them could live off the jungle, remember in those days we had not been taught jungle survival the way we are nowadays in the forces. So they had to make do with what they could. But we dropped, I would think we literally dropped thousands and thousands of pairs of PT shoes, old canvas shoes, for walking out in. Because those shoes, you'd get a pair of new shoes and within 2 or 3 days, of course, they were ripped to ribbons. And they needed more. So we must have dropped thousands of those. Tins of milk. They talk nowadays about what they call a free drop from an aeroplane. In other words, they don't use a parachute to drop the stuff. We evolved the free drop in Burma. And what we did there was you'd get about 30 tins of milk and put them into a small sack and stitch it up as tight as you could. And then put that sack into a larger sack that you just stitched the top of the bag, but you left it completely loose. And you put them on board. And then you flew over the jungle and you picked out where they were coming up to arrive. They were probably on a little knoll and they were camping there for the night or something like that. Or it was a rest period for them for marching on for the next bit because it was probably too hot during the day. And then we would just fly over the top of this and we would push out the whole of our stuff in two runs. We could empty an aircraft in two runs over the top of this free drop. And the basis was that it used to fall down in the jungle And the bottom bag with the tins of milk in, the tight bag, would split due to the impact. But the main of the milk tins would then be caught in the larger bag.
What bag?
In the larger bag. You had one bag that was small and tight, the second one was large and loose. So as it split and the first one broke and they scattered, the second bag caught them. And we used to guarantee to drop those milk on that, and they would get 80%, 90% of the tins of milk unharmed. Fascinating theory. I don't know who did it, but it worked.
Do you think any of it was dropped to the Japanese?
No. 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 I've got confidence in the air crews that went down. I did a lot myself, and when I wasn't doing that, I was stitching bags up for the next consignment. But no, we got so used to it, and we were able to work with the troops, because we did have one or two small parachute things in the first place, and they used those to give us the signal where they were. They put a cross on the ground, and we used to drop the stuff there to get into that. The Japs, of course, never came past after that, so all we were doing was supplying our own troops. The Japs were not there, and they never even got into that. They never got into that range of mountains, so I can say that no, the Japs didn't get anything that we dropped.
Did you drop any arms?
No, it wasn't necessary. We didn't really need them, because at that time they'd gone past the line where the Japanese stopped. They got to the Irrawaddy in those mountains, and that was the time at which they stopped. Remember, it was the wrong time of year to start with. It's the monsoon weather came up at the end, and you could not operate in monsoon weather.
What were the approximate dates of these drops?
Somewhere about, I don't know, May, June or something like that, I would think.
42?
Yes. I do get a little bit vague about some of these dates, and that was a while ago since it happened.
But were some of the units very difficult to locate?
No, I think I don't know whether they had any radio communication. They may have had some form of radio communication back to our ground people on the airfield. But no, we used to know virtually which way they were moving and how many miles a day they could do. So we didn't have much difficulty in finding them and, you know, getting our supplies dropped in the right spot.
Any other work that you did in Burma?
Any other?
Work that you did in Burma?
No, because after that happened, of course, it was getting towards my time for coming home. I'd been there 5 years and I just did normal base work after that. I was back at base until it was time for me to come home. I've actually met two of the chaps I brought out to Burma on that last trip since I came home. One used to work in Bishop Auckland for the same firm as I did. And the other one is the secretary of the Beverly branch of the RAF Association. He was on the last trip out.
When did you go to after Burma?
Well, after Burma, I just went back into India and back to our base at Delhi. And I was working there until it was time for me to come home, because in actual fact I'd gone over my time really on the tour. Officially it was supposed to be 3 years, but I was out there nearly 5 years, 4.5 years anyway before I eventually came home.
How actually did you get back? By troop ship?
Yes, I came on the troop ship. It was one of the requisitions, one of the Strathaird actually, one of the old lines. Strathaird, yes. I came on the Strathaird down to South Africa.
Durban.
Durban. Couldn't remember the name of the place. I was going to say Dunbar, but it wasn't. It was Durban. I came down to Durban, and we were in a transport camp there. And then eventually they took us through to Cape Town. And I was in Cape Town for about a month, waiting for a boat to get home. And eventually we came home on the Mauritania. No escort, just the Mauritania, completely on her own, absolutely packed to the hill with troops. I don't know how many thousands were on it.
Going at great speed.
During the daytime, we zigzagged, as usual. At night time, we didn't. It was just full speed ahead, great speed. We called in at Freetown on the way out, and then right out into the Atlantic, right round the top of Ireland and into Liverpool. And then we did it in 10 days. And that was a big right round trip. It really moved at night. You could hear the whole ship vibrating at night as we put full speed on.
And did you not see any sign of the enemy on that voyage?
No, not at all. We were completely untroubled.
Had Britain changed much when you got back?
Yes, it had, in as much as that they didn't have the stuff that we'd had in peacetime, nor did they have the stuff that I'd had overseas. So it was quite an austere life when you got back compared with overseas, because overseas, at least you've got the fruit and everything else that's out there. I mean, everything, there's plenty of everything out there, plenty of food, plenty of meat, and plenty of fruit. Of course, you get back to England and you find that... I know the first night back in England, we said back after 5 years, because it was literally 5 years to the day when we landed at Liverpool. And we said we'd go out for a drink that night. And overseas, of course, I used to just drink small shorts. And we went to this local pub and the barman said, "What would you like?" And I said, "A gin and tonic, please." And he looked at me and said, "Where the hell do you think you've been?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Gin and tonics." I said, "India for 5 years." He said, "India? 5 years in India?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You deserve a gin and tonic, mate." And he went underneath the bar and he came up and brought me a gin and tonic. He said, "You just don't get that nowadays. You can have some beer of sorts, but no gin and tonics." But he let me have actually had two gin and tonics that night out of his rations. Because there was no fruit. You didn't see apples and oranges and bananas and peaches. And I mean, we used to buy those overseas for, you know, 2 or 3 pence. But stuff like that was completely gone. Everything was blackout, whereas the only time we'd had blackout really was in Calcutta and on the camp at Dinjan in Tezpur. That was when you had blackouts. But apart from that, we had no blackouts anywhere.
I think that you went to the famous 617 squad.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that, as what your recollections are of that famous squadron?
Yes. I came back and discovered I was posted to the Dambuster squadron. Of course, it was after they'd done the raids, the main raids, they'd done those. But shortly after I arrived, we did some more raids. And then I was only with them a short while when I was promoted to a warrant officer. I'd gone right through from AC2 to flight sergeant on that same squadron in India. And I was promoted, and within a couple of weeks of being promoted, I was told, "There's your job to form 54 Base Major Service and Section." And what we did there was we looked after all the special squadrons and the RAF at that time. We used to get brand new aircraft straight from the makers, modify them up to RAF standards, and within 48 hours, that aircraft would be ready to go on operations. The squadrons we looked after were 617 Squadron, which was the Dambusters. We had 627, which was the Master Mosquito Squadron. We had 83 and 97, which were the two Master Pathfinder Squadrons. And then, of course, we had the four Special Master Bombers. Wing Commander Gibson, Guy Gibson, who was ex-617 Squadron, of course. And that was where we taught the new bombing pattern for the end of the war. When the master bomber went out, marked a target, the target was completely set up. So by the time the Pathfinder force got there and illuminated the whole target, all the main force from all the other squadrons had to do was fly over and obliterate the markers that had been put down for them. If they obliterated those markers, they flattened the part that they wanted to flatten. And we built a special trainer to do that. And train the master bombers and trace the master pilots out of the pathfinders and set them up on this job. And we had a special trainer to do that.
Can you describe in detail what specifically your own personal job was?
Yes, I was the warrant officer in charge of the radio section, which meant that I had to oversee the work of overhauling aircraft coming in for overhauls, for fitment of all the RAF modifications, because when we got a new aircraft to make from the maker, it was their basic model, and we had to put on about 40 different modifications, 40 radio modifications anyway, to bring it up to the RAF standard. And of course the other people, the fitters, riggers, armament electricians, they had similar modifications to do. And our job was to get those aircraft in, modify them, repair them, overhaul them, and get them out in the shortest possible time. And I evolved a system with my wireless ops and wireless op mechanics for a quick turnaround, which was eventually taken up by the fitters and riggers and made into a system for the whole of our section. And we used to turn out 50% more aircraft than any other BMSS. And they couldn't know what they wondered why. Because we had a special system which was evolved in my section.
Did they send people to learn from you?
No. I don't think our CEO let them know why he was better than they were.
What were your main problems in doing that job?
I don't know if I really had any problems. We were for a special unit. Therefore, what we wanted, virtually we got. The stores kept virtually everything in that we required. The only problem I ever had, I think, one time with equipment was, as I said just now, we evolved a special trainer, which was actually the base of a link trainer, which the link was removed and the basic platform was used as a revolving target. I don't know if I'm telling secrets here, but because at that time it was. And whether it's still a secret or not, I wouldn't think so. But we made this revolving target. And then in the building, we fitted cockpits. They weren't proper cockpits, they were just made to look like small cockpits for Lancasters and Mosquitoes. And then they were all had radio equipment. And all the radio equipment had to work as though you were actually on a raid. In other words, the pilot had to be able to speak on intercom to his navigators and wireless operators. He had to be able to speak to his other aircraft separately. And, of course, he also had to be able to transmit back to base. But, of course, it was all in one room. And the only way I could do that was by a system of relays. And the controller sat in a control room at the top with big glass panels looking down at everything. And he had to be able to control the whole operation and check it out to make sure that everybody's doing the right thing and learning the right thing. So he